Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. Thank you for being here. It's obviously a pretty exciting time for those of us working on Internet Explorer since we just launched, and I really hope that it's also an exciting time for all of you as enthusiasts and people who work in the browser and who depend on the browser, and who are excited about some of the things that we're doing. This session that I'll give today is one that we've been giving probably for a few years. I forget if it's 2, maybe even 3 years. We've modified it over the years, and different people have given it. But overall, it's been pretty successful, and it's been received pretty well, and that's why we keep giving it. And I think the reason for that, there are 2 reasons for that. One, it's about performance, and everyone is interested in performance. Everyone just wants more of it. It's one of those universal things that, you know, there's no one that says, no, I'd rather have it slower. When you build a UI, there are different opinions, but everyone just wants it faster. And the second thing is, the purpose of this session is to help you build better websites. I'm going to show how IE8 makes this easier, but really the focus of this session is to teach you things to help optimize your website rather than simply demo Internet Explorer 8. To give you a little bit of an idea of the motivation behind this, I have a little sample story. So let's say you're a web developer, like many of you are, and you built a website. Maybe it looks something like this, where you have a, you know, kind of a beautiful layout, very complicated site. You have some live data you see up in the weather. In this screenshot, I had my mouse over one of these links on the bottom. And I don't not only have these dynamic layout menus, but the content or the news that's happening right now. And you're really happy with this site. And you give it out to your users, and they come back and say, well, it's too slow. So what do you do then? Well, I guess one option would be you give them this. This is MSN. MSNBC from 1999. Now, this probably isn't what your users were asking for. This is almost significantly, almost assuredly faster than your previous site, but this isn't really the goal. And we're going to talk a lot about trade-offs today, different trade-offs that you have to make. We're also going to talk about trade-offs that you should never have to make. And performance versus functionality is one of those trade-offs. So my name is John Hrvatin. I'm a lead program manager on the Internet Explorer team. And today I want to help you make sure that you never have to make that trade-off between functionality and performance. My 2 main objectives today, first is to give you real things you can do today that will make your site faster. But I also want to explain some of the principles behind them that you can remember when building sites in the future so you can understand some of these concepts. Couple of the key takeaways. The suggestions I provide today will help you in all browsers. The size of the benefit will vary depending on which browser you're using, but all of these are going to be cross-browser. You'll also find that there are no magic solutions. The tips that I give you here today will help you in some areas or may help some of your sites and may not help others, and we're going to talk a little bit about how you decide and how you realize whether or not these tips are things that you should follow. And of course, you know, throughout all this, you have to consider maintainability, and that'll be a theme that I'll get into more detail later. As I mentioned at the beginning, this is a presentation that we've given several times. So I'd like to start by acknowledging the fact that all the tips here were not just me sitting in my office thinking things up. These were built over time by a lot of different people on the Internet Explorer team, as well as people like yourselves who've written into us and said, hey, here's this, I have this code, this markup that's not performing as I think it should be. Can you help? Or other people in the industry, for example, Steve Souders, the author of a book called High Performance Websites. And some of the tips that I show you in here, he also has in that book. When we started working on Internet Explorer 8, we knew that performance was a big area that we wanted to focus on. And we looked at the browser and said, wow, there's a lot of stuff here. Where should we go make it faster? And our first thought was, well, let's find out where we spend the most time. Let's find the bottleneck and optimize in that area and spend our resources there. So we did a bunch of testing. And some of the testing that we did was to load the top 100 websites and to time how long Internet Explorer spends in each different portion of the browser. Now, how many of you think, i.e., in loading the top 100 sites, would spend 50% or more of its time within the JavaScript engine and the DOM, within the document object model? And how many think it should be over 25% of time it would spend just running JavaScript? Well, in reality, what we found is that it's only 16% of the time is spent within JavaScript and the DOM. This actually surprised us a little bit. We realized that, wow, there are a lot of other subsystems within an Internet Explorer that are used and that are stressed in loading web pages. Now, you may look at this and say, well, sure, Craigslist doesn't require a ton of JavaScript, and, you know, they may be a top site. What about Ajax-heavy sites? So we did that testing, too. We took things like Gmail and Google Docs and spreadsheets and tested those, and sure enough, the amount of time you spend in JavaScript and the DOM doubles, but you're still only a third of the total time spent. And I provide this analogy because when you look at your website, it's important that you don't just look at your JavaScript and that you don't just look at the DOM. That's why today the topics are going to vary across the browser. We're going to talk about HTTP performance. We will, of course, talk about JavaScript and optimizing symbol resolution within JavaScript, but we're also going to talk about CSS performance, and that's where we'll start. The first tip suggestion we have today is minimizing the included style. This may seem rather obvious, but in practice, it can become pretty easy to decide that if I have a large website with lots of different pages, I'm going to create a single style sheet. I'm going to include that one style sheet in all of my pages. That way I never have to worry about, did I put this style in the right style sheet? Did I include the right style sheet? In terms of development practices, it makes it a little bit easier. But the problem here is that all those unused styles increase the download size, which slows down the download, takes some more bandwidth, and also forces the browser to parse and match all of those selectors just to get a failure. So you're not only using more network bandwidth, but you're asking the browser to do a ton of extra work and really for nothing, right? There's no extra benefit for those rules, those styles, because they don't do anything. So kind of the first tip here is minimize the styles that you include on your page. The second one is to simplify your selectors. So there are a lot of times, particularly if you have a site that does have 500 selectors on it, that you end up using very complex element selectors, chains of element selectors, whether they're a child or descendant. These can take a lot of time for the browser to parse and to match. And this is something that when you hit there's a certain threshold, I forget exactly what the number is, where particularly in i6 or i7, and I think in some of the WebKit-based browsers, you really see an increase in the amount of time it takes. And this is an area that we did dramatically improve within Internet Explorer 8, but it's still something to keep in mind. So if you can use class or ID-based selectors, those are much faster. That's because the browser has optimizations in place to look up elements based on their ID or class, because those are things that are done pretty frequently, particularly ID. If you're going to make get element by ID fast, you have to have a great way of looking up elements by ID. And you can take advantage of that same optimization within CSS if you use ID-based selectors. Another tip here is if you do have to use element selectors, try and make them as simple as possible. And the example here is using child selectors instead of descendant selectors. Again, if the browser sees descendant selectors, it has to search the entire tree underneath an element during that rule matching. If you just use child selector, the amount of work that the browser has to do to determine whether or not that selector matches is much less. So here are a couple very simple examples. In the first example, I have a long list of element selectors that, you know, if I can work out my markup in this way, I can make much faster by simply using an ID. And rather than using, in the second example, rather than using a descendant selector, if I can use a child selector, that's also a good way to optimize performance. Now, of course, it's much easier to follow this rule if you've minimized the included style. You don't have to specialize your CSS for large sets of HTML. Third one. Now, this is one that does come out of the High Performance Websites book. But the wording in that one is avoid using CSS expression. And I've changed that. Here I've just said don't use them. And that's because not only are they slow, and they're slow because IE evaluates that JavaScript much more frequently than you might think, but because CSS expressions are not a part of any standard, and we've removed support for them within IE8 standards mode. So these just won't work in the default rendering mode of IE8. So if you're using these in your site today, maybe add this to the list of things you have to kind of wean out of your site, kind of your work item list. And if you're building new sites, avoid using or really don't use CSS expressions. And the last piece that I grouped under CSS performance really isn't exactly CSS. It's more of a layout or a site architecture suggestion. And the idea here is that you want to minimize the page re-layout. And that you want to do that for two reasons. One, if the content on your page is constantly moving around and is updated as it's downloaded, it creates a pretty poor user experience. We talk about performance not only in the lab performance of these are the milliseconds that took to load a page or to run this piece of JavaScript, but also in perceived performance. What does it mean to the user? Did they get their task accomplished quickly? Does it seem fast to them? And if content is constantly moving around as the page loads, that usually appears much slower to the user. And finally, you're asking the browser to perform unnecessary work. And here's where I have a very quick demo. So I'll load this this next page, and this is just a quick sample page that I wrote up. And it loads some text at the top, and if you just try and read the text at the top as the page loads, you'll notice that it's probably not the greatest experience. So I've simulated and made kind of an extreme situation here where the header and the length and the images on the right come in at set intervals. But because I didn't create space for them in my initial page, it caused the text to move. So if I look at this as, well, the text that I want my user to read, or maybe this is a form, maybe this is their login and ID on a password page that they go to every single day. Well, it's there, they can see it, and it's there immediately. But if it keeps moving around, it creates this jarring user experience, and it also asks the browser to do much more work. Yeah, so there's a question on does how you align images and how you align them with the text come into play here, and it does. And so the improved sample that I have here, all it does is create a set aside div. So in this case, I know exactly what size my header is going to be, or if you have advertisements coming in on your site. You can still have that dynamic content loaded, but if you can have some sort of agreement on what the size of that content is, you can set that up in your initial HTML so that your content is exactly where it needs to be, and then you can take advantage of browser optimizations that localize the things that change. So in this second example, when the content came in for the header, IE didn't go relay out and recalculate where the text should be. So it's a pretty simple example, but it's a practice and an idea. It's something to really keep in mind, and really an example of looking at your site as a whole and understanding how users are interacting with your site and how you can take it, understanding that and using that to help optimize. So quick summary on CSS. First thing, minimize your included styles. Second one, use less complicated selectors. Don't use CSS expressions. And try to minimize your page re-layout. Overall theme here, of course, is simplify. The next topic, yeah, question.
Would you recommend still using external CSS or not using external CSS?
This is a great question. So the question is, since you recommend putting a separate CSS page per per site, should I just use inline CSS or use an external file? So some of this depends on how your site is built. There are a lot of places. Let me take a step back. We'll talk about this a little bit near the end when we talk about HTTP performance, whether or not you want to link several CSS files versus inline. And in general, the recommendation is that you want to link external CSS, but you only want to link one file. So you minimize the network traffic that goes down. But if you can use a single CSS file for multiple pages, having an external file lets you take advantage of caching. Now, if you have specialized your CSS such that you have every CSS file on every page is different, and you could never take advantage of caching, in that case, I do think it'd be to your advantage to just inline the CSS. But in a lot of cases, you know, if there are 5 or 10 rules different, you can still put all those in one CSS file. You know, the first rule of minimizing included styles, you know, we've seen in working with sites throughout IE development extreme examples of literally, you know, 600-700 CSS selectors on a page that uses 30. So it's really those examples where you can see a huge difference. So it's funny, in many of these cases, it really gets down to doing some testing and doing some of the performance evaluation. But general rule, use caching by linking to a single external file. If you can't take advantage of caching, because every site uses a different CSS file, then inlining it is the best. Another question? It's a good question. So the question here is there a way to find out if a specific CSS file is used or not used? This is an area so my primary area within IE8, I work some on performance, but the main area I work on were the developer tools. Excuse me. And I actually wish we had I had a better answer for this than saying, oh, yep, here's the tool in IE8 that you can use. But I'm actually not sure of a tool, whether in IE8 or anywhere, that does just a straight rule matching and says, here are your unused rules. It's something I was talking with some other people on the team this week about, because I think it's something that we could build. You could build in JavaScript. If you're familiar with the selectors API, you could write some JavaScript to check them all and see which searches return null. So, I don't know, maybe there's something that we can follow the IE blog. Maybe there's something that we can put on there eventually, a little snippet of JavaScript or a couple pages to help in that scenario. All right, next topic, optimizing symbol resolution. Everyone's just excited about this one, I can tell. This is one of those slides that gets everyone really pumped and the adrenaline flowing. So symbol resolution is the process that any JavaScript engine goes through to determine what a variable name or a function name actually refers to. So if you use a variable name, the engine's got to know what's the number or what does it actually refer to. And symbol resolution is the process it goes through. What I'm going to describe to you, I obviously understand Internet Explorer's architecture better than any of the other browsers, but this architecture is dependent on the JavaScript language rather than our implementation of it. So what I show you here, while I can't say for sure if there aren't little details that are different in other browsers, for the most part, this is just a function of the JavaScript language. And I think you'll see how that why that's true in a minute. So let's walk through the process of you create a variable called name, and then you want to go use that name. And those of you familiar with JavaScript know that if you have a local variable named name, and it's in the current scope, that it's going to use that name, right? So the first place the JavaScript engine looks up that name is in the local scope. The first place it looks, it's really cheap, very inexpensive to use local variables. If it doesn't find a symbol with a for name in the local scope, it'll then move to what we call the intermediate scope. And these could be the outer functions where that function was defined. There could be many of these. There could be very, very few. And it's slightly more expensive than looking something up in the local scope. And the last place the JavaScript engine looks these variable names is in the global scope. And this is somewhat more expensive. This is at least the most expensive of these three. There's another type of lookup chain called the prototype chain. So here's an example where I have an object and I'm trying to access name, which could be a property or a method off of this object. And this is the same, a similar process. They could be either. It's just if in any bit of code, whatever the property is, whatever the method is, if I'm using it, the JavaScript engine has to look it up and decide what it refers to. Oh, for Ajax prototypes. I think even in read-only properties, the same process applies. So the first place it'll look up on the instance of that object. So if this is a particular string object or this is a particular array object, I look up this property method on that exact instance. If I don't find it there, I have to look it up on prototypes. Now there have been prototypes on JavaScript objects for a long time. New in Internet Explorer 8 is the ability to create prototypes off of DOM objects. This also now applies to how we look up methods or properties off of DOM objects. And really, the DOM is kind of the last place I look. So if I haven't found it within the instance of the JavaScript object or in any of the prototypes, I'm going to go see if this is a built-in method in the DOM or if this is a built-in object in the DOM. And that's really the most expensive lookup that I can do. And I'll explain why a little bit later in the presentation. But for now, we'll just take what we know about symbol resolution and look through a few code examples. So this first one seems pretty innocuous. At least to me, when I first looked at it, I said, okay, what could I possibly optimize in this code? But the thing to understand is that while I'm accessing the variable called local variable, to me it's a local variable because I wrote the code and that just seems to be how it makes sense. But in reality, this is creating an expando off of the window object because there's no var keyword. The JavaScript engine looks at this and says, huh, I'm not going to create a new variable because it's not called, doesn't say var in front of it. So I'm going to look in the local scope and I'm going to look in the intermediate scope. So I'm going to look in the global scope and then I'm going to say, okay, is this an object that I have? No, and I'm going to get all the way to the DOM. It's going to be pretty expensive, or at least much more expensive than what I thought it would be. The very simple optimization here is just use the var keyword. You know it's a local variable. You only need to use it in that local variable. And this will speed up this bit of code. The next one here is to recognize implicit lookups. So if I step through this code, I'm calling getElementById to get an element, and then I'm clearing the contents of it by using innerHTML. Now innerHTML is in the DOM. So this is a somewhat expensive lookup. And I'm going to do that once to clear it. And because I'm using plus equals in each one of these other calls to continue to append and add on to that innerHTML, each one of those calls innerHTML and does that lookup twice. So in total, for this little bit of code, I'm calling innerHTML 7 times and doing this lookup. If I refactor the code slightly, I can avoid this. So the idea here is to batch your changes up within the JavaScript engine and then only access the DOM and only perform that DOM lookup the minimum number of times. And in this case, I was able to get it down to just a single HTML, innerHTML reference by calling the build title, build body, build footer separately and then just setting innerHTML 1. Yes. The question was, is this a kind of code optimization? And it is. And that's what a lot of these samples are, just kind of ways to optimize your code to help it run more performantly. I'm not sure if that's a real word, but it's one that we use all the time. So I'm going to pretend it's real. Then you guys will go with me. You can tell people I told you it was real. Next one is recognizing multiple DOM lookups. So here I'm calling document.body.all. And I call this same string of objects 3 times. Now, while that's one single line of JavaScript, it actually performs multiple lookups. So I have to look up the document first, And then the DOM gives me back the document. And I say, okay, now I have a document, what's body? Okay, now I know what body is. Okay, now that I have body, what's all? And it goes through this process for each one of these. And if I'm going to call that same string, that same set of objects in the same order repeatedly, like in this example, I can cache that one. So now I'm only going to perform those multiple DOM lookups one. And then when I use that variable, I only have to access the DOM one. So here, unfortunately, I don't have the counts on the screen for this one. But here, in the previous one, I was calling document.body.all three times. So I probably said nine times. Yes, the suggestion is you could also write this as a with statement. Yes. And then in this one, I've gotten it down to three the first time and only in six total. The examples I've shown you so far have to do with variable names or DOM objects. The same is true for methods. So when you use a method and, or a function name, the JavaScript engine has to look up that name. So in this case, if I'm iterating through a collection and I'm calling a function in each iteration of that collection, I have to look up the name for it. So in some cases, it's advantageous to create a function pointer and use that function pointer instead of asking the JavaScript engine to look up that name every single time. Now, at this point, you may be asking yourself, are these really the types of optimizations that are going to speed up my site? Is this really where my site is spending all of its time in what seems like these very small, minute optimizations? And really, the answer is it depends, right? There are places where this can really become the bottleneck, and that's where you have expensive name lookups that go into the DOM, particularly if you're going through loops, if you have large loops, large collections of data. Now, you obviously don't want to have to hand analyze all of your code and find these. This is where tools really help you, because you need to have the information to make this trade-off. Because if I were to create a function pointer for every function, my code would very quickly become unreadable and much less maintainable. So I really only want to optimize when needed. So how do you know when you need to? Well, that's my second demo here is of the IE8 JavaScript profiler. Let's take a look at that. So the page I have here, contains all the code samples that I just showed you in the last slide. So you see this is test one. Runs work on local variable. One doesn't have the var keyword, and another one does. I have the build UI one, where I call innerHTML seven times, versus build UI two, where I call innerHTML once in each iteration. And I run these through, and in this test, I'll run these through some large number of times. You see, test one, I run 100,000 times. Test two, I only run it 1,000 runs on. And what I want to do is understand the performance of these. Now, how many of you have used or seen the IE8 built-in developer tools? Yeah? Okay, only a couple people. So let me take a minute to show you those or at least introduce you to them. From either the Tools menu or by pressing F12, you can access these built-in developer tools. These tools are not an add-on. They're not something extra that you have to download and install. These are built into every single instance of Internet Explorer 8. So if you have to debug on a client's machine, on your family member's machine, anywhere, these tools are there. And they're also not running or not doing anything when they're not open. So if you've never pressed F12 or if your family member has never pressed F12, they'll never see them. And if you open it up and then close them, they're gone. You're not going to see any performance impact, any negative impact of having these tools around. To the higher version of IE8. And that is something that I think there's a later session on deployments and talking about that. And hopefully what we've seen, actually we got an email just this past week from someone who said, hey, I work in this development organization in a large enterprise, typically one that, this person described as more conservative in deploying new versions. They said, I'd really like to use IE8 because there are all these developer tools and the JavaScript debugger and other things will really help me. And, because of things like IE's compatibility view, to let you be backwards compatible with older sites, plus the productivity advantages you get from things like the developer tools, even if the rest of your organization is using IE7 or IE6, they found that their IT department is actually pretty willing to try a pilot. So it's something that, you know, obviously we hope that IE deployments happen frequently and smoothly and in large numbers, but it's something to at least approach with your own IT organization, and, you know, in pointing out some of the advantages of using IE8, even if it's only within a small section of your org. So the developer tools have a bunch of features and functionality to let you inspect your site. So they have the built-in DOM tree to show you the HTML. Obviously this page doesn't have a whole lot of CSS, so the right pane shows me all the CSS that applies to the selected element. There's CSS, so see there is none. There's also a full JavaScript debugger. So there's no more going into Visual Studio or Visual Web Dev Express or the Microsoft Script debugger from however many years ago. This is a full-featured, you know, watching variables, stepping through code debugger. And the piece I'm focused on today is the profiler. So our goal here was to really make this, really in all the tools, make it as lightweight, as simple as possible. You know, if you start playing with the debugger, you'll see that there is no attach to process step. You just press start debugging and you debug. In the profiler, you press start profiling and now you're profiling. Now, after I start profiling, I run the scenario that I'm interested in. Some of your sites that may be opening a couple of menus or navigating to a new site. In this example, it's just pressing the button that runs all the tests. I press stop and I have all my data. Now I'll pull this out into a separate window. Huge, since this is on a higher resolution than I had opened before. And you can see that I have all the data and all the timing for all of my methods that I ran. So I can look through and see how many times each of these functions were called, the inclusive time as well as the exclusive time. There is a URL and line number field here. If I had enabled JavaScript debugging first, then I could get that debug information here as well. For this example, I know exactly where everything is, so I'm not too interested in that. There's a number of other information. So you can get inclusive and exclusive time percentages, as well as average, max, and min. So now I can go through. I can say, well, is that one optimization around local variables and using var really that important? Or how about accessing inner HTML once instead of seven times? Let's take a look. You can see work on local variable. It definitely got smaller. Went from 159 to 145. Maybe not something I really want to focus on for this particular site. But if I look up at build UI 1 versus build UI 2, I mean, wow, right? That's a huge gain. And now it running, that same code is running at a fraction of the time it took to run it before. So this is one that I'd really want to try and replicate across my entire site and a best practice that I'd really want to latch on to. And you can see how the tools let you really find those hotspots and find those bottlenecks to understand if this is a place where you want to focus. A couple other things with the tools. You can export this data out to a CSV. You can dump it. You can also perform multiple runs. So if I wanted to pin this back again, you know, run another run, I could do that. And now I have both reports loaded and I can switch back and forth, export them, compare them in Excel, any of those things. So that is the JavaScript profiler. So the question is, one of the slides pointed out to not use LTR and RTL in the same in the same page and same selector. I think it's just in the same page. So that's one of those, like I mentioned, this is something that we've built on over time. That's one of the ones that we just found as we were optimizing IE8. You know, lots of times we'd find something we would improve in IE8 and say, wow, here's the best practice for IE7. It was pretty slow there. And that's one of those. I don't, unfortunately, have a great example of that one explicitly or a good understanding of exactly why that's slow. But using those mixed mode was something that we had found to be slow. So the next topic is JavaScript coding inefficiencies. First one is JSON. How many of you use JSON in your sites at all? Okay. JSON, how many of you are familiar with it or aware of it? Okay, good. So JSON, JavaScript Object Notation, is a great data interchange format. It's a really simple way of sending data from the server to the client and quickly taking those strings and that data you get from the server and putting it back into JavaScript and making it usable right away. The problem with JSON up until now has been that you had these two choices of what you wanted to do when you got this string. You could either run eval on it, or you could use a custom parser in JavaScript to sanitize that JavaScript and make sure that all it is JSON and not a bunch of malicious JavaScript that's going to steal or do something malicious to your site. Unfortunately, this is one of those trade-offs that you just never want to have to make. It's either get the improved performance, and like I mentioned there, eval actually isn't that performant, or I get improved security. And this is a trade-off that I think, you know, at Microsoft we hate making because, you know, security is always, you know, P0 on our list of things to do. So we are always looking for ways to make sure we never even have to face that trade-off. And this is one where we didn't want you to face the same trade-off either. So instead of using eval or custom library to handle my JSON, IE8 now includes a native JSON object. So instead of using your custom ones, we have a JSON object that has two methods off of it, parse and stringify. And yes, the name stringify comes directly out of the ECMAScript 3.1 current draft. We didn't come up with stringify on our own. And it also provides prototypes, a toJSON method on the prototypes of date, number, string, and Boolean. So what you get from this is that you get the speed of just running eval. In fact, it's a lot faster than eval, and yet you still have the same security benefits of one of these custom JavaScript libraries that sanitizes and cleans your data. This is one of those features that if you do use JSON, or if you find yourself in a place where you want to use JSON or you think it could be beneficial, by all means, take advantage of the built-in JSON object. It will have only, it will really only help your site. Right now, IE is the first browser to provide native JSON support. Firefox 3.1 betas, I guess soon to be named 3.5, also introduces the built-in JSON object. So in the future, when that releases, you'll also be able to use it there. And I imagine that because this is so popular, I imagine other browsers will quickly add it as well, and maybe even have it in some early version, early build. All right, I'm actually going to skip that one. Okay, next one, switch statement. So this is another one that, you know, I first looked at and said, well, what could possibly be wrong with a switch statement? So my background is in web development. It's in C and C++. That's where I did my computer science courses were mainly in that. And one of the things we learned, and in some random compilers class that I've forgotten 99% of, is that switch statements are optimized in the compiler. The compiler doesn't just turn it into if, else if, else if, else if, else if. It uses a lookup table, or something else much more efficient. JavaScript engine does not do that same thing, and it does just turn it into if, else if, else if, else if. So in most cases, this is fine, but if you have a switch statement that maybe 1,000 cases long, and you find that the case that's hit most frequently is near the end or is the default case that you always fall through to, a much better approach, or at least an approach that you should evaluate and then run through a tool like the JavaScript Profiler, is creating a lookup table. So you've created a lookup table and then used the try-catch to look up and effectively perform the same functionality of a switch statement just in a little more optimized way. Next one is property access method. This is one where a lot of times you want to write very clean, maintainable code. So instead of accessing properties directly, you'll create a little wrapper function. So you can always call, you always know that no matter what I do, I call get this property or set this property. The problem here is that calling a function, it creates a lot of overhead, particularly when all you're doing is returning the value in that function. You're not performing any other work or validation of the data. The overhead of creating the function dominates the amount of time spent performing the whole action. So really, our recommendation here is if you can just access a property directly, to just go ahead and do that. You know, maybe there are places where it just helps you guys so much that you can just tell everyone always use get, set, the methods and they work because you do validation. That's good, but once you actually have to, it's better to just use the access the properties directly. And this is connected to that instantiating DOM function. It's costly, particularly when those functions do very little. It's something that we have improved quite a bit in Internet Explorer 8, but it's still a place where you can, you know, kind of eke out some of those last performance gains. All right. I believe this is the last one of the JavaScript coding inefficiencies, and we're going back to the lookup chain and the symbol resolution here. If you remember, one of the key things we talked about was that the DOM access was always the most expensive. And the way I look at this is I've got two pieces of land, and they're connected by a bridge. But that bridge is a toll bridge. And every time I cross from the JavaScript engine into the DOM, I'm crossing this bridge, and I have to pay this toll because I'm going through this abstract generic interface. And that interface is great because it means that if you want to write a script engine in any language, you can just plug it right into IE and it'll work. But it creates a little bit of overhead in these calls. And then this is another area that we improve rather dramatically in IE8, but you'll still see some gains if you can avoid some of the really costly design patterns that I'll show you in a second. This is just a small diagram to kind of point out at least the architecture within Internet Explorer. As far as I understand, all the major browsers have this same overall architecture of the JavaScript engine being separate. This is how you have multiple WebKit browser-based browsers all with different JavaScript engines. The actual JavaScript engine is a separate piece from the DOM that's contained within the rendering engine. So this is where, you know, as the JavaScript engine has to access the DOM, it crosses in IE into MSHTML, which we refer to as Trident, and that's where you can pay some performance costs. And here's an example. This is probably my favorite example because I was giving this talk last November at one of our tech ed conferences. And that morning, I got an email to one of our distribution lists internally from a web developer at Microsoft who said, hey, I wrote this code on get elements by class name. And whenever I have huge collections, whenever I'm looking these things up in huge sets of markup, it takes forever. And I figured out a way to make it faster, but I don't understand why. And he was just asked for a little explanation and a little understanding. So we looked at this and said, well, the problem here is that you're paying that toll many, many, many times. So the first time, the first thing the function does, I shouldn't say first, is I've clipped a lot of the code out so you can just see the relevant pieces, but it calls get elements by tag name and gets the elements collection. Then it iterates through those in a loop. Every time it iterates through, it calls elements.length. Well, guess what? I'm going to look up what elements is, and then I'm going to access the DOM to figure out what the length is every single time. And then when I access that elements collection, again, it's another lookup into the DOM, because I have references to DOM objects, not to JavaScript objects. And this is where things really slow down. Yes. That's a great suggestion. So rather than accessing elements.length every single time, I could store exactly. And here's, in this improved version, I didn't do that particular optimization, but that's another one that that would help. The optimization that I have here completely gets rid of accessing the DOM in my loop. So early on, I pay the price of copying all the elements in the DOM into the JavaScript engine, and then I do all the work locally, and I do all that work. This speeded up, I think, in this person's example of the head of rather large site, it speeded up, I think, by 75 or 80% improved. Now, you know, maybe you'll, if you have, sometimes you're working with small markup, sometimes you're working with large markup, maybe there are places where you don't want to pay the cost of copying the array from the DOM into JavaScript, but this is something that was, you know, real world example of a property at Microsoft, I'm actually not sure which one, where they were able to do that and really get a huge perking out of it. Okay, so there are, I think there's one more. The smart use of DOM methods. In a couple of places, there are built-in DOM methods to do things, and in general, you want to use those. For example, if you are just iterating through a list of child nodes, just one by one, in general, it is much faster to just use next sibling. Not a ton of background here, except that we can optimize next sibling, and we have done so. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. Oh. So when you're using XML query to iterate through the node list? So what was the question? Is that all? Yes, it should. Because it's the same, if I understand it correctly, the XML and the XML that how I use handles XML is through MSXML, which is effectively another component in the same way that the JavaScript engine is another component. So I don't know the details of just how much of a gain you would get, but it would be something that you could test out with a profiler. So here's another method. Now, I talked about the selectors API a little bit early on in trying to write a tool to figure out, find unused CSS selectors. How many of you have used the selectors API or are familiar with it? Few people. Okay. We are familiar with CSS selector syntax, right? Like the dot, the pound, child, descendant. Okay, a few people. So the CSS selector syntax creates a very powerful and flexible language to let you say this small bit of text should apply to these types of elements, whether it's based on their tag name, their ID, or their class, or a whole bunch of different properties about that element. And it's really helpful in applying rules to elements. The selectors API lets you use that same language when you're searching for elements in the DOM. So instead of just being able to say, get element by ID, and I can only search by ID, I can use this method called query selector all. And I pass it a string. In this case, I'm looking for dot required. So what I get back is a collection of all the elements that have a class of required. Now this created a huge, really powerful way of searching for elements in the DOM, because you can use this CSS selector syntax. And this is also a place where this is a new API in Internet Explorer 8, and it's pretty highly optimized, and we've optimized it there as well as to be able to, like I mentioned before, we improved the speed of just the selector matching in general. And you get to take advantage of those optimizations also when using this API. Okay, JavaScript coding inefficiencies. Use the native JSON object, turn large switch statements into lookups, avoid property access methods, minimize your DOM interaction, and use query selector all when you're searching for groups of elements in the DOM. Yeah?
The CSS kind of, you know, coding, better coding standard that you mentioned, does it apply to even jQuery?
Sorry, does which apply to jQuery? I didn't quite.
The CSS performance, you mentioned about, you know, using navigating to the child node instead of descendant.
Yeah.
Does it apply to jQuery also?
I'm not sure. I would imagine that the same way, I would imagine that it would, because the general principle is that if I have to look for an element in just the children of an element versus all the descendants, then it's going to be faster to look in just the children than all the descendants, unless all the descendants are children, in which case it'd just be the same. But I would imagine that unless jQuery has in some way optimized their ability to look up descendants, then I think the same rule would apply. So kind of the general principle is being, you know, if you think about it and say, look, what does the browser have to do when I ask it this? Right? Like, does it have to do less or more? And a lot of times, you know, you guys are developers, you can think through the logic of, you know, like, okay, if I had to search through a big tree, this is going to be, it's going to get faster if I can search through a smaller tree. So I think the same thing would apply to jQuery, but I haven't run any specific tests of my own. Okay, last section. Only got about 5 or 6 minutes, so I'm going to move a little bit here. It's probably a good thing because most of the things in this section are available in the High Performance Websites book. Steve Stouders goes through those in good detail, and he has a lot of good samples on his website as well. So, Steve Stouders. It's Souders. So a typical visit to a website, you request all the content from the server or the cache, and then you have all this work done in the browser. Talked about the work in the browser. This half is really how do I get this content down or how do I structure my site to optimize how this content comes down. First suggestion here is HTTP compression. Use it. So things like gzip are available pretty much everywhere now. In the requests, in your accepting coding, you include gzip, and in your response, it gzips that the content, and then it'll decompress it on the client. One of the things to pay attention to here is that you only want to compress things that aren't already compressed. So if you have a text file like CSS, JavaScript, those can compress really well. If you have a JPEG, in the best case, your compressed JPEG will be exactly the same size, but you would have lost all the server processing of doing the compression. And in the worst case, you would have actually increased the size of the JPEG because those are already a compressed format. So that's one thing to pay attention to there. The next one, it seems pretty simple. Well, it is pretty simple, but it's a mistake easily made. I'll tell you a story in a second. If you're using an image as a small icon or small image, it's only, for example, 50 by 40, don't download an image that's 500 by 400. Right? Just use an image that's exactly the size you need it to be. We did this, sadly, on the IE blog. We put a little Happy New Year book post. There was a big, massive image of like a champagne glass or a hat or something like that. And it was just huge. And we just didn't realize it, right? You throw up a post kind of quickly, you don't think about it. This is one of those maybe, you know, my final publishing steps, like, hey, let's make sure that all our images are the right size. Another idea, and this is we talked about a little bit earlier, is file linking. So instead of including several CSS files and several script files, you can optimize the number of HTTP requests and responses that you have by including a single JavaScript file and a single CSS file. Now, the reason you still want to link it instead of inlining it is so that you can take advantage of caching if you happen to use that same CSS or JavaScript file on several pages. Many images. So if you have, if your page includes tons of images, you have lots of image elements, every one of these is going to be a separate set of network requests, obviously. There's a technique that can help you optimize this called CSS Sprite. The idea here is instead of downloading, 16 different images, I'm going to create one big image that contains all 16 of the images that I want. And then instead of using image elements, I'm going to use divs. And I'm going to use CSS to set the background of these divs and position that one image in just the right place so that the image that I want comes through. This lets you optimize the number of HTTP requests and responses that you get. It also, at least when I first saw this, I said, well, you know, if I have all that empty space probably in between my images, isn't it just going to increase my overall download size? And in some cases, it may, but it's usually pretty tiny because the image compression formats like a JPEG do a pretty good job of compressing the white space between that would be between those images or just a constant caller like that. So the next set of things are about repeat visits. So this is generally about taking advantage of the cache when you have users who are regularly coming back to the same site. And the first one is providing time-conditional responses. So when the browser sends out a request that says, I'm looking for this content, and I only want it if it's been modified since this date, the server should send back 304 that says, hey, not modified, just use the one you already have. This is one step in the right direction, but you're still doing the network response. You're still getting the you're still asking the server to respond. You can optimize this even more by using what's called a far futures expires header. So if on the initial response I send an expires that says, hey, don't even ask me about this until this time in the future, then the next time the browser goes to send the request, it knows to immediately service it from the cache, because it already has the information that it needs. Some people in the past have asked, well, what if I do want to update this in the future? How do I do that? The general technique that they talk about in the book and that I think people generally see is that you modify the file name. You add a timestamp to a file name or something. That way, when you do update it, you just give it the new timestamp. Then we can always have a far futures expires header, but it's really easy to rev the file itself and to force all of your users, all of your sessions, to get the latest bits. Script blocking. This next recommendation is a factor of how browsers handle script elements. So in the past, so Internet Explorer 8 has changed. So I'll save Internet Explorer 8 for a couple of minutes. So right now I'll talk about IE7 as well as all other browsers. When browsers parse the HTML and they hit a script tag, they stop doing anything else. They don't wait for that they don't send off that download and then keep going. They stop because they're like, well, this script could modify the entire page, so I don't want to waste time doing extra work that may just become irrelevant. The problem is this prevents progressive rendering. So if you have a script tag on top of your page and that script takes a long time to download, your users are going to sit there looking at a blank page. Instead, if you were to put the script tag at the bottom of your page, the browser would go through, parse and render all of the HTML, and then you could have your script tag just at the bottom that it would download. We were recently looking at a compatibility bug with SharePoint. And just in looking through their site, I thought that they had a pretty clever solution to this. Because sometimes the main content on the page requires JavaScript. And what do you do if it's not loaded? Your users are going to start getting script errors. So what they did was they took the tiny little bit of JavaScript that just set up an error handler. And it was minified and compressed. This is a tiny little bit of JavaScript that they load at the top of their page. And it sets up an error handler that anytime it gets to a script error, it changes the status bar to say, please wait while scripts are loaded. Right? And for the most part, if you just click the hyperlink or other things, it all just works. But if they happen to hit something that depends on script that's not there, they get this little message, not the yellow exclamation point, just this message. And then at the bottom of the file, at the bottom of the HTML, they link in their huge JavaScript file that does all their other functionality. They thought this was a pretty good optimization. Now, IE8 has improved this by doing what we call speculative downloading. So we no longer stop when we hit a script tag. We just keep going. We're going to kick off the script download, and we're going to go find other things that we can start downloading at the same time. Now, IE8's also increased the default number of connections you can make with a server. So between not blocking at script downloading and running and allowing 6 connections to a single domain at a time, this has dramatically improved performance in many ways and for many sites. So again, Steven Souders has a couple example pages and wrote this article after we released beta 1 saying, wow, here's a simple page that takes 10 seconds to load in IE7 and in Firefox and takes 4 seconds or 3 seconds in IE8. That's one of the places where one of the reasons we think people see big performance gains within IE8. I'm sorry? Is it implementing asynchronous? I don't think we We do it all on different threads necessarily, but it is asynchronous. There are a couple places where we'll still block the number of downloads, but yeah. So tools, right? How do you know if these are some of your bottlenecks, if these are the performance problems for your site? A common tool is Fiddler. Raise your hand if you know Fiddler. Most people, good. You guys all know that Eric sitting right there is the author of it, right? Okay. Fiddler's a great tool for doing this. There's a new plugin for Fiddler called Nexpert that's designed to help aid in performance testing while using Fiddler. Unfortunately, it's a pretty new tool, and I haven't had a chance to really put together a demo of that yet, but I wanted to make sure you guys had the link here, and I'm sure the slides will be available in some way afterwards, so you guys can get some of these links. Okay, overall, reduce the number of requests you send, combine external script styles and images, and use caching. Reduce the size of those requests through HTTP compression and conditional requests, and avoid blocking factors by putting your script at the end of the HTML. And that's really it. That's what I have today. So, you know, the kind of general principle here is you want to identify the bottleneck, the performance bottleneck that is applying to your site, by using some of these tools and understanding the architecture of your site. And then you want to look to reduce, simplify, and then refactor. And with that, I'm happy to take questions.
So Firebug has a add-on called FiSlow that Yahoo has put together for recommendations on what you can do to improve your performance. Do you plan on having some sort of an indication in the dev tools as to best practices and how you can improve your performance?
Yeah. So FiSlow is actually created by Steve Souders. So Steve at Souders at the time was at Yahoo. He now works at Google. And he wrote this book. And what that tool does is run all, I think, 10 or so of the rules that he puts in the book on your page. And that the tool is a plugin for Firebug called YFlow. And it's a great tool. Unfortunately, it's not part of IE. It's built into developer tools. It's something that we're definitely looking at in different places of in different tools groups within Microsoft, but right now we don't have an equivalent tool. However, all the recommendations that Steve makes in his book are things that work cross-browser. I think maybe the only one is CSS Expression. It's the only one that's IE-specific because other browsers don't really support expressions at all. So it's something that you can run and take all those same optimizations and use them in IE. It's also something that something that we clearly would, is an excellent tool. Eric has a comment as well.
So one of the cool things about Nexpert is basically that it does the same thing that YFlow does. So it'll actually evaluate you against criteria about whether or not you can cache or resources or whether you're delivering a lot of oversized images and so forth. The nice thing about YFlow is it's kind of designed to sort of shame you, and that you get a bad grade and you're like, oh, I really got to fix this, whereas Nexpert actually just provides you, like, here's the files that you should go compress, or here's some files that you might not have known about that, are large and so forth. So the Nexpert plugin actually does get you kind of most of the way there. What it doesn't provide you is that grade AF. You probably could add that. For now, yeah. And John's point overall, that if you tweak, with Firefox and do the same group, they're going to apply to IE as well. But if you don't have Firebug or don't want to play with YFlow, the next work plugin is the chance.
Thanks, Eric. Other questions? All right, cool. Well, thank you, everyone. Appreciate you taking the time to be here. My email address is at the beginning of the slides, too. It's just John HRV. It's not a typo. I saw all the consonants in a row. It's supposed to be that way. I don't know why, but it just is.